Do you read Sutter Kane?
This is not a Sutter Kane story. This is not reality. Not reality. Not reality.
This is reality.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Back to Junk Food Cinema here on Film School Rejects and our four-week examination of the underrated horror of the 1990s. I am your host, Diane Brian Salisbury, and I am joined by my co-conspirator, my fiendish friend, screenwriter slash novelist, C. Robert Carkill. Yeah, we're doing the Simpsons thing.
Yeah, that happened.
We're doing the Simpsons, changing the names and the credits for the Treehouse of Horror episode thing. I don't care. I like it. It's what we're doing.
All right. I'm C. Robert Carkill.
Which actually, it's too bad we're not talking again about our favorite killer car movies, because C. Robert Carkill writing any of those would have been great.
But we did that already.
We did that already. So we're going to move
on.
Can,
if you have not heard it, you can go back in our logs and find it.
And that episode is called Killer Cars from Interstates. That entire back catalog of episodes, in fact, is available on both iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema, or you can follow us on Twitter @junkfoodcinema. And the movies we talk about at any point on any episode, we'll put up Amazon links for. Do click on those links, even if you don't buy that item. As long as you buy something from Amazon via that link, it benefits us, and we really do appreciate it.
Thank you!
Schlocktober continues! And today, once again, we are paying tribute to a master. The work of John Howard Carpenter has had no small effect on me as a film fan, and I'm sure I can speak for Cargill as well on that.
Yeah, yeah.
The guy has so influenced not only like how I love film, but how I watch film, how I dissect genre in general. Like, the guy is absolutely phenomenal on so many levels.
Yeah, well, one of the things that really works about him is most of his best work, he injects science fiction into his fantasy and horror.
Sure.
And treats fantasy and horror with a science fiction element that grounds it in some level of reality for us that he always makes interesting films. Even when they're failures, they're very interesting failures. And today we're talking about his last great film.
Yes. Today we're discussing what I feel is one of his very best movies, and the one that doesn't get mentioned in most conversations about his canon for one reason or another, and that is 1994's In the Mouth of Madness. Now, if you haven't seen this film, like I said, I'm not entirely surprised, because when people talk about their favorite Carpenter films, inevitably they will bring up Halloween, they will bring up The Thing, they will bring up Big Trouble in Little China, they'll bring up Fog. All great movies, absolutely.
And?
Escape from New York? Escape from New York, of course, yes.
Snake Plissken?
Yes.
Seriously?
Yes.
Seriously?
I'm trying to do like five things at once. Get off my back, damn it. Anyway, so yes, today we're discussing In the Mouth of Madness. If you've not seen this film, the basic plot is as such. Sam Neill is, he's sort of an independent investigator that works for insurance companies, and his job is to sniff out when claims are real and when people are bullshitting and submitting phony claims in order to, you know, to profit off the insurance company. He's really, really good at his job. Well, he is kind of brought in as a consultant on a very strange situation where a publishing house has filed a claim for millions of dollars because one of their chief great writer by the name of Sutter Kane has gone missing on the eve of the release of his latest book, In the Mouth of Madness. And they need this book. They need the money that it's going to bring in. So they file a claim on their insurance. So Sam Neill's job at this point is to figure out where Sutter Kane is, if he's really disappeared, or if this is entirely a publicity stunt by the publisher. So he is sent with an editor from the publishing company to a little town in New Hampshire where he believes Sutter Kane may be hiding. And it's all about the weird shit that occurs between basically leaving and arriving in this tiny little New Hampshire town.
Yeah.
Which may or may not also be the setting of one of Sutter Kane's books.
And that does appear to be the plot of this film. But it's not really the plot of this
film. No, see, this film, you know, I like to say this about it. It is the absolute best adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft that isn't actually based on any one H.P. Lovecraft story.
Yeah, and for years we referred to it as the very best H.P. Lovecraft movie ever made because, frankly, there weren't a lot of them. You know, H.P. Lovecraft was, because a lot of his stuff was public domain, was mined by a lot of low-budget filmmakers and companies to use his name to get people to see films that ended up atrocious. And there's only a handful of decent to good adaptations. I would never say there's a truly great adaptation. There's a close one with Dagon, which is by
Stuart Gordon.
Stuart Gordon.
Yeah, much like Reanimator is by Stuart Gordon as well.
But it's still not perfect, and he acknowledges it was not the film he wanted to make. And we'll go into that. While we have a moment, Stuart Gordon was supposed to make Shadow over Innsmouth, and he was supposed to make that in the late 90s for a studio. And he kept bringing designs to it. They did makeup tests. They had all this stuff. They were moving forward, and they were one step away from a green light. And I shit you not, one of the studio suits in the room said, "I don't get the Fishman thing. Can we make them vampires?"
Oh, for fuck's sake.
And he said, "No, we can't make them vampires are really hot right now. No, we can't make them vampires." And so Shadow over Innsmouth, and then they said, "Well, if they can't be vampires, can they be werewolves?" He's like, "No." And he's
like, "Okay. For fuck's sake, no."
And so they canned the film. And so out of that, he went and made Dagon, which is the best straight adaptation.
You know, while we're on that subject, do you know a lot about what happened? Because Guillermo del Toro also famously was in the process of making an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation of At the Mountains of Madness.
Which everybody thought this was before this came out. When we first saw the announcement that John Carpenter was making In the Mouth of Madness and he talked about being inspired by Lovecraft, we thought he was making some kind of adaptation of At the Mountains of Madness. And then we saw this, we were like, oh, it's not that, but we get it.
Yeah.
The problem with Guillermo was Guillermo wanted to make a $150 million rated R movie that shot entire sequences down in Antarctica. And everyone was like, that's crazy, Guillermo. And he's like, no, trust me, it'll work. Eventually they got flustered, and I forget what movie they made instead. They made some other movie that didn't.
Wait. The studio made
instead? Yeah, the movie, the studio went and they had a choice between greenlighting this or greenlighting some other, and I'm blanking at the moment what that movie was, but that movie ended up not being good, and we were all like, really? This was the movie you made instead of At the Mountains of Madness?
And then, of course, Guillermo went on to do Pacific Rim, which if you watch that movie, there's a very specific point where one of the kaiju coming out from the rift at the bottom of the ocean very much resembles Cthulhu kind of coming into our world from the old world, and I just felt like it was almost like a, not so much a middle finger as it was a, just sort of a cathartic moment for Del Toro to just at least have that.
You know, he was, I can honestly say he was really broken up by that when he came. He brought a Dragon Slayer to Austin to screen, and it was just after all this fallout, and he was teary when he talked about it. He had put a lot of work into it. It's been his dream project for a long time. He almost had it, and it was a $150 million Tom Cruise movie that was rated R, and the studio was like, we don't think anybody's going to see that. We don't think it'll make its money back. And so they went another direction. But as Lovecraft on film, you know, the only other mentionable notes are, as you mentioned, Reanimator and the Dunwich Horror, mm-hmm. Which is a cool 70s freaky movie, but is worth checking out as far as Lovecraft goes. But all the other Lovecraft adaptations have fallen on their face. And this was very inspired by Lovecraft, not only in theme, but there's little Lovecraft jokes peppered throughout.
Well, there's not just Lovecraft jokes. There are entire lines from Lovecraft stories that become dialogue in the movie.
Yes.
Or are read aloud by characters as if they came from the works of Sutter Kane.
Yes, which Sutter Kane being an amalgam of Stephen King and
H.P. Lovecraft. Sure. There's a great line at the Black Church about its being the seat of an evil older than mankind and wider than the known universe. And that's actually from the Haunter of the Dark, and the line about the illimitable gulf of the unknown as Sam Neill stares into the dark is the last from the last paragraphs of The Rats in the Walls. And then, of course, Mrs. Pickman at the hotel is a nod to the short story Pickman's Model. But
yeah, well, Pickman, so, Pickman Hotel instead of Pickman's Model, yes.
Yeah, yeah. It was Pickman's Motel instead of Pickman's
It's Pickman's Hotel.
Is it?
Because I noticed I was watching specifically for that because I remembered that. And I found it odd that they didn't make it a motel. They made it a hotel because Pickman's Motel would have been a better joke. But Pickman's Hotel made more sense in the movie.
Sure, but, sure. Even structurally, it's owing a lot of its existence to Lovecraft, because it's about the way it starts is with Sam Neill having been driven insane.
I'm not insane!
So they're interviewing someone who has beheld arcane creatures, who has gazed into a nightmarish dimension of darkness, and the very sight of the things there contained has driven him mad.
And who is interviewing him, out of curiosity?
David Warner.
Yes.
Darkness himself.
Yeah, is the great evil. You know, as we talked about
evil himself, yes.
A few weeks ago on our episode about Time Bandits.
Yeah.
It's a very small role in the movie, and he bookends it. But he bookends it very interestingly, because this film has a very, very interesting structure, and there's very peculiar things about it.
Yeah.
Because the thing about this film, and why I respect it so much, and why I agree with you that it is one of his very best movies, is this is an art film masquerading as genre trash.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some trashy genre elements to this film that are very deliberate, very careful, and to some people seem like bad melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
But are supposed to seem like bad melodrama.
Sure.
Because what this movie really is about, and do you want to get into this?
Jump into it.
This movie is not about an insurance adjuster who is seeking out, trying to find out where Sutter Kane is hiding. This is a movie about a protagonist in a novel slowly finding out and resisting the belief that he is stuck in a novel, that he's a character in a novel, and that his creator is sending him out into the world to destroy it.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a whole running thing throughout the movie about questioning the very nature of reality, and reality is a construct, and what that means, and it's all about perspective, and like, whose reality is it? And that's something that I always find really fascinating in movies. And it's not really done in a way... it's not aloof. It's not pretentious. It supposes a world where one man is given total sway over the laws of existence because he is creating it, and not in a god way, but literally in a creator, creation, author, character type of way, which is really interesting. Not only as an homage to the power of Lovecraft and as a nod to the greatness of his writing, but I mean, when you think about it, that man, also the man who is creating all of this, the man who holds sway over existence, happens to be the creator of horror fiction. So it's possibly, in a more tertiary way, Carpenter acknowledging the effect of his own work had on people. It's him almost like kind of embracing the fact that there are people that are going to forever see him as somebody who peddles schlock, who peddles genre nonsense. But really, you know, he's got a lot more to say, which I think is, when you look at the production design of the movie, why I think the actual Sutter Kane novels, if you look at the way that they're packaged and the way they're on store shelves, they really do look like trash. They really do look like trashy sci-fi novels.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that when you start digging into the depths of Sutter Kane as a character and the power that he holds, it's almost like Carpenter, almost not really patting himself on the back, but just kind of acknowledging that there is something there. There is something to the notion of being a creator of fiction and what that means and the responsibility therein.
And Carpenter's a guy who, as we talked about in the previous episode, tipped off a revolution and changed the way horror was made. With Halloween, he inspired imitators that spawned imitators of them. So many people ripped off Friday the 13th, and Sean S. Cunningham for years denied it and ultimately finally admitted, yeah, no, we were really all just ripping off Carpenter the whole time. And Carpenter spawned that whole thing. But Carpenter created a movie that really impacted people. I mean, I remember when my mother, I was 4 years old when Halloween came out, and my mother had won tickets to go see an early screening off the radio. And my mother came home that night and freaked the fuck out. That movie scared the shit out of her. And for 3 weeks after that, every night she barred all of the doors in our house with 2x4s.
Wow.
I mean, it really, really affected her. It affected a lot of people. It really scared the shit out of people. And he created a movie that just profoundly impacted, you know, the mainstream. And he saw how it affected people. And this is also kind of a nod to that without being, it's him talking about that effect without him, you know, gloating about it.
It's not gloating so much as it's embracing legacy, yeah. I think. And it's interesting. If you think about the fact that, as you've said, and as I totally agree with, this is his last good film before...
His last great film.
I honestly think it's his last good film, period. Like, I'm not a fan of vampires. Ghosts of Mars is atrocious. Village of the Damned, what the hell? Like, so I have not found anything that he's done since this to be worth watching, quite frankly. But if you think about this kind of being a major tipping point for him and being almost a last gasp, and the idea of the movie in some form or fashion being about him surreptitiously acknowledging legacy, that makes an even more interesting and layered film to me. Yeah.
But at the same time, it's so smart how he goes about it, because there's so much, like some of my favorite bits about this are the early scenes with Sam Neill. Like not the opening and end sequence, the bookend sequence, which exists. Here's the weird thing about this movie. This movie exists on three levels. It exists on the level that you are a person watching In the Mouth of Madness. And then there's a level right below that where Sam Neill exists in a reality that's kind of our reality, where he's watching In the Mouth of Madness at one point. Like, he's watching the film that we just watched in a theater with about as many people as I saw it in when I went and saw it opening weekend. And I'm not kidding. I saw this movie twice in theaters because I loved it. And no one was ever there. So I was always watching it alone. So the scenes where Sam Neill is watching the movie in the movie theater and no one's there, and I'm watching it in the movie with no one's there, it was just kind of like, all right, this is kind of fucking
awesome. And then you pull back and there's another artist drawing an artist, and there's another artist drawing an artist.
But so there's that level. But then we have the level when we're in the book, which is most of the movie. And those first few scenes, you know, it seems very amateurish at first glance. Like, there's the scene where he and his buddy are in the coffee shop.
Yeah, yeah.
And his buddy is giving that cliched...
Played by Bernie Casey, by the way.
Yeah, Bernie Casey giving that, you know, I always knew you were good, but seeing you in action, you're the best there is, and I really want you to work for
me. He's like, well, that's because people are amateurs. I really want to go up against a pro.
And then there's a guy walking up to the window with an axe, and they both turn towards the camera to look at this thing, so they're clearly not looking at this dude. Mm-hmm. And then we have a scene a few scenes later after we've had Charlton Heston starring as, you know, co-starring as the owner of the Arcanum
Arcane Press.
Mm-hmm. And there's this scene where he, for no reason whatsoever, Sam Neill starts hitting on Styles.
Yeah.
Like
big
really,
time. Super
not
sleazy.
Only big time, but super sleazy, super creepy. And she does this coy thing where she turns his back and I was like, oh no. But she turns and starts facing the wall.
Yeah.
Like it's like no filmmaker is right mind, especially not the filmmaker who made all of these great films in the 70s and 80s, would do that shot unless it was very deliberate. And what he was doing in that is he was setting up the cheesy kind of melodrama that you get in the type of fiction that he's aping. That what he's trying to very subtly tell you is you're in the Sutter Kane novel. Like, this whole movie is the Sutter Kane novel.
Yeah, well, when you think about the scenes you just mentioned.
Yes.
What happens immediately after that? Immediately after that, we get three almost back-to-back-to-back scenes of Sam Neill in his apartment talking on the phone to Bernie Casey, who we don't even see.
Yeah.
So he's literally just like, and the great thing about, you know, based on what you've said, the great thing about the life that those scenes take on, because he's literally saying things like, yeah, they're actually better written than you might think. It's not just trash.
Yeah.
So when you think about the fact that he's saying that within one of those novels, that he's in one of those novels complimenting the writer of the novel.
Yeah.
It's like crazy meta to the M.C. Escher degree. Stairways going everywhere.
And that's what I find so brilliant about this film is, and that's why I think it had a hard time, you know, grasping people, is there's these silly aspects. I feel like if this movie had been directed by David Lynch instead with the same script, we would have ended up with a film with the look and the, you know, supposition of pretension if you will, that audiences would have delved deeply into. I mean, I remember, you know, the first time, you know, when Fire Walk With Me came out, you know, people were questioning, what did the blue rose mean on his lapel? Like every element in every shot, there were theories about, and this was the kind of film that had that kind of level of attention to detail paid to it, but people weren't paying attention because, well, it's just the guy that made Halloween. Yeah. And this is a movie where if you start pulling apart all the small pieces, there's something behind everything in all of these films.
Well, and the great thing about this movie, about this script, is that, you know, based on what we've been saying, this whole dream logic idea and this, like, various levels that it's operating on, it makes for an incredible replay value.
Yes.
Every time I watch this film, I pick up on something new.
Dude, the narrative changes every time you watch this movie.
It's kind of creepy.
Yeah, and it's one of those movies that the more I watch, the more I start, you know, questioning what I think about the film in terms of what it's really about.
Well, the conceit is so well formed that there are various clues throughout the film of Kane's influence over reality. I mean, it isn't until you hear Kane say,
"Did I ever tell you my favorite color was blue?"
that you realize that up to that point, every character in the movie shown in close-up has blue eyes. Every single character that is shown in close-up has blue eyes, and you don't even realize it until you hear that line and then you go back and when you watch it again, it's this subtle note to his influence over this entire world.
Yeah.
My favorite color is blue. Everyone who's going to be shown in close-up is going to have blue eyes. Then there's the fact that John Trent is in cell 9 at the asylum, and then later checks into room 9 at the hotel in Hobbs End. Like, all these little things that you catch the more you watch it.
Yeah,
you know, and you're right. The narrative changes each time,
and it's really fascinating just the detail that's played and how the characters camp it up. Like, you know, my wife has watched it with me every time I've watched it in the recent last few years because I watch it every once in a while, and she always forgets why it's so campy.
Mm-hmm.
And she always comes every time we watch it. She's like, "Oh God, this girl's so awful." I'm like, No. This girl's actually really nailing this role, but nobody, you're not at this point real. And we talked about that tonight. She's like, "Oh shit. Yeah, I totally forgot. Oh yeah. No, she's really like playing up like a 1950s actress."
Mm-hmm.
Like, and she's nailing it. Like, yeah, the old B films that Carpenter grew up with.
Yes.
That's exactly
that he's
what she's
watching
doing
at various points during the movie, by the way, as, yes, a subtle clue of that. He's watching Robot Monster throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
Sam Neill is watching the movie Robot Monster, which is one of Carpenter's favorite 50s B movies.
Yeah.
So you definitely have that. I want to talk something about Carpenter that I noticed in this movie that I've never seen him do before. If you think about the shots in the oeuvre of John Carpenter that people remember, you think about the opening shot of Halloween, that long, slow pan shot, or you think about the shots in The Thing where they're doing the blood test and there's just a lot of long, unbroken shots. The editing in In the Mouth of Madness is unlike anything I've ever seen in a John Carpenter film, because suddenly It's edited like a music video. Like, there are montages of quick, rapid-fire cuts to heighten the sort of nightmare within a nightmare aspect. Like, it is rapid-fire. And it's crazy to watch because as you're watching it initially, you're like, why does this feel different? Why does this feel like a different Carpenter film? And it's not just the multiple narrative levels that it's operating on. He literally has designed the movie to look different based on how it's edited.
Yeah.
And it's like the opening shot of the film is we're just watching a rapid montage of a printing press set to music that sounds almost exactly like Enter the Sandman by Metallica.
Except like, very Carpenter.
Oh, it's very Carpenter, but it almost like I was listening to it, it was like, like, yeah, that sounds almost exactly like Enter Sandman.
Hush, little baby, don't say a word.
But it's so unlike, just down to the very marrow of this movie is so unlike anything he's done before, and yet he pulls it off in a way that is absolutely undeniably his.
Yeah.
And I love that about it.
No, it's really a masterfully made film that very few people actually pay attention to, as, because, you know, a lot of his films, you know, they kind of happen. You know, he got lucky and he became a better filmmaker over time until this point.
Yeah.
And there's lots of, you know, discussions you can have about why he dropped off after this. But this is the pinnacle. This is this was the potential he was always promising in terms of what he could do, but it wasn't a story that caught on with everybody.
Which is unfortunate. And and something else to note about the way this movie looks is this is the first time he's worked with cinematographer Gary, I believe it's, you pronounce it Kibbe, K-I-B-B-E, because for a long time he worked with Dean Cundey, but their last project together was actually Big Trouble in Little China. So this is the first time he worked with Kibbe, who ended up shooting pretty much everything Carpenter did from that point on.
Which is why all of Carpenter's stuff looks exactly the same from that point on.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. But I will say that Kibbe does a great job with this film of playing up the very shadowy, the very misty, the very... Like, when you are on these alternate narrative levels, when you are in these alternate realities, each one kind of has its own signature texture to it. And I feel like that's a combination of the way it's edited and the way it's shot. And I think, you know, I agree with you that going forward, they all very much look the same. But I think Kibbe did some really great stuff on this one.
Oh, yeah. No, there's some really great shots here. And there's some and the shots plus the editing. I mean, they really do create that dreamlike craziness. And there's all sorts of just really smart things too. One of my favorite just little smart filmmaker moments is when we look down at the clock before she changes the radio, and it's 1:41, and it's blackout. It's 1:41. You know, it's 1:41 in the morning. She goes, she changes the radio station, and then all the weird shit starts happening. And all of a sudden it's daylight, and Sam Neill wakes up. He's like, "Oh God, you drove through the night." And you know it's not even fucking 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Like, you know, because he very subtly just moved that in without, you know, most filmmakers would go for a shot of the clock and then track over to something. And you would know that's what you're looking at. But because she goes and fiddles with the radio, you're not even really processing that you were supposed to know what time it is. And then you know exactly what time it is when all this happens and realize just how fucked up this is.
Yeah, I mean, she goes over the bridge and there's this really sort of chaotic segment, sequence where, you know, the light is blaring through the slats on the old wooden bridge. And you realize that you've passed through something more than time.
Yeah.
You haven't. This isn't just a time span, though, a time jump that we've gone through. This is something, you know, very different. And I love the fact that they have created this town of Hobbs End, which is from one of Sutter Kane's book, Hobbs End Horror, that doesn't actually exist within one of the narratives. Does not actually exist.
And this is the fourth level.
And now we've entered level four, which is just pure subconscious. Wait a minute. No, that's a different.
No. Level four is. What we're supposed to think the books are. It's the book, within the movie we just watched.
Within the lunchbox, the video game, the t-shirt.
Like, it's, yeah, it is, this is the cartoonish version of the horror movie that has all those horror elements, and this is where we really get to see all of the pure Lovecraft come out and play.
Yeah.
But we're supposed to believe, and that's what one of the things I love about just how meta this movie is, that this is the world within the world.
Yeah.
And we're not even thinking that world is within the world. That's within the world we're watching.
See, and that is a benefit of the fact that Sam Neill is playing a sort of pessimistic tourist in the world within the book, because everything he's seeing, he has read enough to recognize what it's from, and yet the whole time he thinks it's all a publicity stunt, so he's still a sounding board for
actors,
the audience.
And hidden speakers, you guys are fantastic.
Yeah, so he's still the sounding board for the audience, but at the same time, he doesn't believe a word of it.
Yep.
So it's not as ham-fisted as, oh, wait a minute, that was in that book, and that was in that book. So you can't even trust what you're seeing that is unreal being real to the guy who it's unreal to. Like, my head's going to explode if I keep tracking backwards through the various levels of mystery that are going on, the various narratives, the various levels on which this movie works. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's like spelunking. It's not even like watching anymore. You are spelunking through narrative levels you didn't even know existed.
Yeah, this last time that
stratum
I watched it.
Stratum upon stratum of narrative.
The last time that I watched it, I decided to watch it just from that structure point to follow which level I was at every point in the novel. And the thing that really holds it all together is Sam Neill is that same character in all three realities that we're watching, the, you know, final reality being ours. He really is that guy. And I love how so much the dialogue in the movie plays into that ending. You know, you've got that great, you know, what if you were the last sane person on earth, you'd be locked away in a room And it would be so lonely being that last person. And so, of course, you have not only him being locked in the room, but when he finally gets out of the room, he goes and watches a movie alone in an empty movie theater.
And it just happens to be In the Mouth of Madness, starring him, John Trent.
Yes, starring John Trent.
And Linda Stiles. And like,
When you look at the movie poster,
It's all of the names from In the Mouth of Madness as far as production crew, but then the actors are the characters in the movie.
Yeah, and this movie is just, it's kind of fucking crazy brilliant in a way that just doesn't get recognized.
In a way that,
it's sad. It's very sad that this movie doesn't get this.
It's a travesty. And it's funny, like, I feel like if we kept dissecting the layers and we kept going further, we may go insane. Like, we may actually end up in a padded room somewhere just babbling about narrative. Well, we'll see. Let's talk about this for another 3 hours and see where it leads us. But one of the things I do want to mention, the effects in this movie. Because it's not, I wouldn't call it an effects driven movie because it's a while before that we actually see the big effect stuff. But even in the subtlest of constructions, K&B effects, which is,
yeah,
of course,
this is young, hungry K&B.
Yeah. This is it Kurtzman or Kirkman?
It's Kurtzman.
Kurtzman, Nicotero, and Berger. K&B effects, like one of the top names in the industry.
They started out doing stuff like, you know, Tarantino and Rodriguez's films, and then moved on to, you know, doing Carpenter. They did a bunch of other stuff, and they've since gone on to do, you know, really small things, Hostel, Walking Dead, pretty much every bloody effect you've seen over the last 20 years came from K&B or somebody who worked for K&B at some point.
But here's my point about their mastery is even in the smallest of constructions, you see how good they are. And it's like when you find out that, you know, in Harold and Kumar, a very Harold and Kumar Christmas, the Waffle Bot was built by K&B effects. Yeah. Like,
Awesome. Well, they've always been
awesome. Amazing. And in this movie, there's that shot early on that we've actually alluded to already, where the axe-wielding maniac comes crashing through a window, and he crouches down to ask Sam Neill the great line of the movie, which is,
"Do you read Sutter Kane?"
And when Sam Neill doesn't give him the answer that he wants, he looks at his eyes, and we see that he has double irises, and it looks like two cells mid-mitosis. Like, his irises are splitting apart. And those are contact lenses made by K&B, and it looks fucking phenomenal. And it's this tiny little effect.
And that we see that effect throughout the movie.
Yes.
And right up to the final line when Sam Neill takes an axe to a guy, he's got the double irises as well.
Yeah.
Do you like the book? Oh, I love it. Then this won't come.
Then this won't come as a surprise. So great. And then, of course, we get the various, later on in the film, the various monsters that spring forth from the wall. And holy crap, it's a mesmerizing combination of animatronics and men in suits. And it took over 30 fucking people to operate. Like, that last shot, we was running down the corridor, and we just catch these shadowy glimpses of these awful, unspeakable things that are following him, that are giving chase. It's absolutely amazing how much care went into the construction of each and every monster, one of which could not resemble Cthulhu more if it was actually Cthulhu. And it's funny, too, because, you know, as they're operating this big wall of monsters is what they called it. At one point, it apparently ran over Nicotero's foot. So, and it's like, I guess, big as that thing is, and as much as it took 30 people to operate.
Hey, don't call Greg's feet big. Come on. Come on.
Greg Sasquatch Nicotero getting his feet run over by the wall of monsters at the end. And then, of course, there's the upside down Stiles sequence, which is freaky as all hell.
And is from what was at this point a deleted scene
from The Exorcist. Yeah, absolutely.
So this was something that we were supposed to have seen, hadn't seen, and since have gone back and seen.
Right. So in the scene, it looks like, so Stiles, like, they're in the full throes of whatever the fuck is going on in Hobbs End, and they're just trying to get out. But every time he tries to get out, something
pulls you back in.
Yeah, I had that same thought.
They pulled me back in.
So he's in the car with Stiles, and she comes out of the car, and you just hear this awful, like, bone-cracking sound. And then she comes out of the car, and it looks like her head has spun around backwards, and then she's doing a crab walk. And the way they pulled this off is that they had a contortionist wearing a mask of the actress. But this whole effect falls apart completely if that mask is not believable. And I watched this movie three times before I was like, oh yeah, that is a mask. Because the first three times I watched it, I was like, that looks like a real person's face.
It depends on how big you watch it and how HD your TV is.
Are you really? Are we going to compare sizes now? No. Get the tape measure. We're doing this.
No, because it's, it's one of those things. It's a really good effect, and it's a really good effect for its time. But depending if you're watching it in HD, you can actually kind of see the mask lines a little bit.
I think that's crap. I think that's crazy.
But at the same time, it's a really great effect, and it's still creepy as fuck. So yeah. I'm not kicking it in the balls, but it's one of those effects.
Because its balls would actually be on its throat, I think.
Where do you kick a contortionist?
I don't know.
I don't know where they are at this point.
I guess we're assuming it's a male contortionist at this point. But either way, it's a damn good effect. And the weird effect of, you got the sweet little old lady in this movie who is played by, what is her name? Frances Bay. Frances Bay, who's probably known to most people as Happy Gilmore's grandmother. I mean, she's been playing, her whole career, she kind of played sweet, lovable old ladies. In this movie, she's an old lady who's fucking terrifying. And at one point in the movie, transforms into this axe-wielding, tentacle-chested... It's not cool to look at. Like, I didn't want to look at it anymore. It was going to give me nightmares. But apparently the way that shot was accomplished is that it's in miniature. Like, that whole effect, the whole monster, I assumed it was some kind of practical puppet, and it was, but they shot it in miniature because they had a person in a suit, and Carpenter didn't think it looked real enough, so they did that whole shot in miniature, and it's crazy to watch because it
doesn't look miniature at
all. It doesn't look miniature at all, and it's freaky as all hell, and I really do love that shot because in addition to being monstrous and seeming like this otherworldly monster, it's also wielding an axe and chopping somebody into pieces. So it's like the best of both horrible worlds. Hooray! But yeah, the effects in this movie have always been a big draw for me. In addition to all the great story stuff, in addition to all of the very elaborate narratives that are weaving through this movie, and in addition to Sam Neill basically playing like three characters throughout the course of this movie.
Effectively, yeah.
He's completely insane. Sutter Kane is going to destroy the world, herald of doom, Sam Neill. And then he's also suave, sophisticated 90s sleazeball Sam Neill. And then he's also, I've completely given over to the Sutter Kane madness, and now I'm an instrument of the apocalypse, just like he is, Sam Neill.
Depending on which level of the movie you're in.
Depending on which circle of the movie. I think we should just call them circles at this point. The third circle of In the Mouth of Madness. And of course, speaking of thirds, this is the final leg of John Carpenter's Apocalypse trilogy.
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah. Apocalypse! Woo! The first two being?
The Thing, followed by?
Prince of Darkness.
Yeah. And so how this works and how his Apocalypse trilogy goes is The Thing is the dawn of the apocalypse. It's the, this is what brings about the apocalypse. Then there is Prince of Darkness, which is the taking us to the precipice of the apocalypse. We are at the moment right before the apocalypse happens, the world's about to end. And this is after the apocalypse has happened. The movie takes place after the apocalypse has started and people are dying. And in fact, there's this great shot. I love this shot, but I swear to God, Danny Boyle stole the fucking shot. It is not, he doesn't steal it verbatim, but tell me the shot of Sam Neill walking out of the asylum with all the paper strewn about the yard and the abandoned van isn't almost exactly like how
Cillian
Danny
Murphy
Boyle
walking out of the hospital in 28 Days Later.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like when you see that, it's like, oh, 28 Days Later is the movie that follows immediately from this point in the movie.
Yeah.
It looks like how they dressed that up to look like the apocalypse is exactly how Carpenter did it in 95.
Yeah.
And it looks, it's really cool how he does that. But yeah, so that's his Apocalypse trilogy. And if you've never watched the Apocalypse trilogy back to back to back, it is a hell of a watch because all three of these films are so fucking smart. Mm-hmm. And they all play with science fiction in very different ways. You have The Thing, which plays with it in the obvious way. It's an alien from another planet that can duplicate physiology.
Yeah.
Then you have the really cool, weird sci-fi element of
Prince of Darkness,
which the name keeps falling out of my fucking head, where they're sending this message back from the future, and it's inhabiting the dreams of people, and they're sending it back through tachyons, which decay the further back they go. So they're getting this smaller, they get the small fragments of message, and the message gets longer and longer as they approach the film, as they get closer and closer to the future where they're sending the message from.
Yeah.
And it's just this really cool, small little sci-fi element added into this wonderful fantasy
horror. Not only that, but it's
film.
Like, it takes the tenets of Christianity and makes them sci-fi concepts themselves.
And so then we move into this, where the science fiction concept is he's playing around with alternate realities. And that you can look at this because he treats those alternate realities with almost a sci-fi take without ever addressing it scientifically. He is talking about parallel realities and these multiple layers, because essentially what you're looking at is you're looking at a multiple universe film where a character who exists in this alternate universe that is fictional is sent into this reality to bring the madness from that reality with it.
Yeah.
And he goes up levels, bringing the madness with him all the way until he reaches what is ostensibly our reality and unleashes the apocalypse.
There's a great scene, you know, we talk about him walking out of that asylum, which, by the way, is a water purification plant in Toronto. Apparently it's been used for several films. But they had to stop allowing film crews in there after the terrorist attacks on 9/11. I'm not really sure. I don't know enough about threat levels to give any kind of theory as to why that happened. But right after he walks out of that asylum and he walks into the movie theater, if you look in the distance, I mean, like, you're hearing on the radio about, like, don't trust your friends, don't trust your family. This is now reaching an epidemic level.
If you're one of the last people who's uninfected.
Yeah. So you know shit's going down, but, like, it's empty, empty, empty. And then as he's walking into the theater, just in the background, if you look in the distance on the sidewalk of the streets way, way blocks down, you can see people, or at least what used to be. It's really freaky because, again, it's one of those things that Carpenter, did with Halloween so well, with the shape. And it was just the shape, and there wasn't a lot of detail to it. He wasn't jumping out of the bushes and scared. He was just standing there. And there's something about that last little moment that kind of reminds me, and again, going back to the idea of his legacy, that is not only a really creepy shot in and of itself, but kind of reminds me of the shape, of Halloween, of how he started, and the effect that he had on people. So I think it's like this perfect little end note to where, I'm sorry, I unfortunately consider we lost John Carpenter. He never made another film after that. That's where I draw the line. That was it. He didn't make anything after that. And it's such a great little bon voyage moment in my head.
Well, and that, you know, who we didn't mention,
who?
This movie also has Viggo the Carpathian.
What the shit?
Yeah.
What?
No, yeah, no, from Ghostbusters 2.
Like in a painting?
No.
No, the actual actor?
The actor who plays Viggo the Carpathian is the guy who is the father of two of the children who have been taken by Sutter Kane.
You have got, oh my God, it is. The actor's name is Wilhelm von Homburg. And
really?
It is absolutely.
That's
him.
Kind of amazing.
And it's funny too, because everybody in the town of Hobbs Inn seems like they're vaguely German. Like, I mean, Sutter Kane himself is played by Jürgen Prochnow, who has possibly the most German name next to Wilhelm von Homburg.
Yeah. And who, by the way, we haven't mentioned, he's fucking awesome in this.
Oh, Jürgen Prochnow was amazing in this.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is Viggo plays Wilhelm.
Wilhelm.
Wilhelm plays one of the few towns members who know that they are characters in a book,
mm-hmm.
and who know what's going on and keep trying to tell Sam Neill that this is what's going on. You are a character in his book. And there's the great, you know, the great moment early on with the paper boy. And he's like, he won't let me out.
He won't let me leave.
And it's this, and you understand the horror of this small, very, very small character who knows that they're a character in a book and they can't get out of the book.
Right.
And then you have this other character, and, you know, played by Wilhelm von
Homburg.
Nazi something.
Nazi something. Jesus Christ.
No, he's not Jesus. He's Viggo the Carpathian. There's a different long hair.
Scourge of Moldavia and Carpathia.
Where he's, you know, he keeps trying to tell Sam Neill, get out while you have a chance. You know, you don't belong here. This is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the moment where, you know, he's like, my daughter did this, my son did that. Then he puts the gun in his mouth, and Samuel's like, don't do it. He's like, I'm sorry, this is how he wrote me. And bam, and that's the, and it isn't until Stiles has read the book that she knows that she's a protagonist and she's being written.
Mm-hmm.
And he still doesn't believe it. All these characters keep coming to him and saying, look, we're characters in a book. This is not, you are not living your own life. Get out while you can. And he refuses to acknowledge it because he's just a character in the book. And he's that character in the book that is also kind of aping what was going on in the 90s. You know, in the 90s, that was what most horror movies and horror TV shows were. You know, that's every episode of The X-Files is, I believe there is something crazy going on here. And then Scully would go, no, there must be a scientific explanation. No, let's
like Scully, how many times do we have to go through this shit before you just start believing?
Yeah. And serious. So he's the Scully. He's just walking around going, this is all fake. I don't believe any of this. None of this is real. I want my truck back. I want to talk to the cops. And that's, you know, he refuses to believe that. And there are all these great little small characters that are like trying to tell him the whole time because they know, because this character of Sutter Kane is lording it over them.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, I am your God and you will worship me and I will destroy you all. And I'm going to destroy the world above us.
Yeah.
And it's really a fascinating horror element, but it was really cool to see him in that because, you know, he's not a guy we've seen in a lot of stuff.
No, and he actually died kind of young, which is the sad bit about that. He died in his early 60s back in 2004. So it's, yeah, we didn't get to see him in much. And I actually completely missed that it was him, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. No. The second I saw him years ago, and I'm like, it's Viggo. And then I always forget it. And then he shows up, and I'm like, oh, it's Viggo. He's the guy with the double barrel shotgun that fires three bullets. which is the one glaring flaw in this
You've
movie.
Nailed it, the one flaw.
Like, it's the, you know.
The ballistics is the problem.
Of all the things
you're going ballistic about the ballistics.
Attention to, he's got a double-barreled shotgun that never reloads and fires three times. And it's just one of those things where you just kind of like, dude, really? Like, everything else, every minor detail in this film you paid attention to, except he just keeps firing.
Yeah. But that glaring error notwithstanding, I still truly believe.
You noticed that as well, didn't you?
I actually didn't.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
I was more fascinated by the monsters and crazy shit going on.
Well, but this particular scene that fires three bullets, the monsters are dogs. So it's a bunch of Dobermans attacking.
And they don't hit any of them, which I actually enjoyed quite a bit. Because it's like, those are devil dogs. You can't hurt them.
Well, yes, but also because this year in particular in horror, for those of you paying attention and those of you watching all the movies within the next year that we just watched at a bunch of festivals, this is the year of the dog killing,
which is awful and horrible, and filmmakers should be ashamed of themselves.
Everywhere. One year we had rape, one year it was bear traps, this year it's killing dogs.
Why can't it just be bear traps and rape? I mean, what, come on, like, why does it have
because
to
we got used to bear traps and rape, and rape became and we entered the era of the SJW, and rape wasn't cool to put in a movie anymore. It wasn't extreme, it was a way to piss people off, and so people are like, oh, that's not scaring people anymore, it's not freaking them out, not making them feel uncomfortable, it's making them angry. Let's move on to something else that will make other people angry, killing dogs.
Bullshit.
But not in this movie.
Not
John
in this
Carpenter
movie.
Don't kill no dogs in this movie.
In the
but he does have a shotgun that fires three times.
That's true.
That's a double barrel shotgun.
Well, that brings us, of course, to the fabled junk food pairing. And for this movie,
what do we put in our mouth of madness?
Well, into our mouth of madness, we stuff the KFC Famous Bowl.
Oh no! God damn you!
And I have an explanation.
God damn you! Better.
Patton Oswalt has commented that the KFC Famous Bowl is a failure pile and a sadness bowl. And while that may be true, it also bears resemblance to an unholy abomination from a dimension older than mankind and wider than the known universe. And if you think about it, we've been talking about the various circles of this movie and the various layers upon layers of narrative structure, and it really does feel like you're traversing the various circles of hell as you go from narrative to narrative. Much like with every bite of a KFC Famous Bowl, you feel like you're descending like John Milton. You feel like you're descending like John Milton through the various circles of purgatory. And the very idea that one must consume all these items at once is utter madness. A madness that you can rather inexpensively shovel into your mouth, all the while second-guessing your own reality and indeed pondering the very boundaries of sanity and insanity.
Of all the KFC stuff to kick in the nuts, you didn't go for that. You didn't choose that sandwich where the chicken patties were the bread?
No, I'm sorry. No, it is far more an abomination. the fucking...
I beg to differ. They were like...
You know what? I'm going to let you start picking the damn junk food pairings because you argue with every single one of them.
Because I think it's funny.
I'm going to stuff your mouth with the madness that is the KFC Famous Bowl.
Fuck yes. Let's go do that now.
Oh, God. Oh, I have started
madness
something.
Madness Bowl. Get me a Madness Bowl.
I have started something I cannot finish. Get me out. He won't let me out. Well, that's going to bring us to the end of another episode of Junk Food Cinema. Thank you very much for listening. I want to remind you yet again that you can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Hovering over a KFC Madness Bowl.
Apparently. The Madness Bowl. Oh my God, we've coined a new...
That's it. It's the KFC Madness Bowl. No, you can find me on Twitter, at Massaworm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M, or on Facebook.com/Massaworm.
Awesome. You can find me at Bri Guy Salisbury on the Twitters or on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianSalisburyCritic. Or you can also find me at my home away from home, oneofus.net, doing podcasts, doing blogs, doing blow, all kinds of crazy stuff. I think we established last time that I apparently have a cocaine habit. So sure, we're just going to go along with that. And I want to remind you yet again, we'll be continuing all through Schlocktober our series on underrated horror of the 90s. Next week, I feel like I want to tease next week, but I'm not gonna because, haha. Cargill's giving me this look like, what?
But that's terrible. I feel like I'm going to spend some time at the end of this episode by telling you, fuck off. We're not telling you
No, it was me vamping, trying to come up with a suitable teaser for next week, and then I couldn't come up with one.
We're talking about one of the most underrated horror movies of the 90s, a movie that actually was responsible for me getting a job recently in Hollywood.
All right, there you have it. That's a thing to look forward to. So for Cargill, this is Brian signing off by asking with no small amount of ominous intent, do you read Sutter Kane?